Christian Blood, KTSA News.
Seems like these days, a lot of conversations start with the term went viral. And I guess that's the new way of saying everybody knows or everybody's seen. There's a lot of talk today about this video that was, I think, first appeared on the New York Post website. That's where I saw it for the first time this morning. And it's a guy on TikTok from Venezuela. They say his name is Lionel Moreno. He's somewhere near Columbus, Ohio. He's an illegal immigrant. And he is making a TikTok, which, by the way, let's face it, we've come a long way from, you know, they're living in the shadows to they're making TikTok. He's making a TikTok about how illegal immigrants who are coming into the country should invade, his words, unoccupied homes and declare squatters' rights. He says in the video that he has seen where there are laws or there's recognition that if people go into a house that isn't currently occupied and they occupy it, they can declare squatters' rights. And there have been stories anecdotally around the country of people who had rent houses or were on trips or whatever, and they would suddenly find, or they bought a house that they had been led to believe was vacant, and they would show up to move in, and there would be people or a person in the house who would have them arrested when they attempted to come in and occupy what they believed and had paperwork indicating was their house. This guy is very fiery. He's very confident. And he is saying, you should come into the country and this is how you should live. In fact, he says, I'm going to start a business teaching and guiding people on how to do this. And there are various laws according various degrees of protection to trespassers inside houses and ways of establishing legal occupancy in a house where someone else actually has the note or the deed, but you now have occupancy rights, squatter's rights. And that is the most upside down. I mean, I know I didn't go to law school and I'm not the smartest guy, but that's the most upside down backwards thing I've heard about. And it happens. And I was thinking to myself, I was kind of juxtaposing this story, this video of this guy just ranting about come into the country and take these houses, with the video you've probably also seen on the news today of a border crossing where about 100 illegal immigrants stormed across the border, plowing through wires and barriers and knocking over I guess Border Patrol or Texas National Guard, I'm not exactly sure which agency it was. And the Texas National Guard eventually established control of the area, but there were a number of people who got into the country. They were running full tilt. They were tearing through the people. They were tearing through the wire. And I just couldn't help but put that together with the guy saying, break into houses and take them over. Because these people are breaking into the country. These are two different kinds of home invasion. This country is being invaded. Remember when you couldn't say that? Remember when people said that and it was considered racist to call it an invasion? If Greg Abbott or Donald Trump called it an invasion, that was like you were using a dog whistle word or term. But that's clearly what it is. And remember when we were told living in the shadows? That's not the case anymore. And remember when we were told asylum seekers, these are just people fleeing a bad situation. It was like they were Jesus, Mary, and Joseph coming into Bethlehem. But when you watch these people tearing through the border, that's clearly not our image or our idea of poor people seeking asylum, waiting, hoping, pleading, I didn't see any of that in the video. And, you know, I'm wondering if these are the building blocks, the bricks, the straws that break the back, whatever analogy you want to use, that are going to be the tipping point in this whole thing. Because when you look at the polls and you look at, oh yeah, more and more Americans are worried and they believe the border and illegal immigration is the leading issue in the election or one of them, there's still people that say no to these questions. I know that Biden has bad marks in the surveys on immigration, but there are still people that approve. Who could they be? Who the hell are they? Who could approve of that? Who could have trouble recognizing that for what it is? It is an invasion. And it is violent. And when they're going to say to you, we're coming for your house, I don't know, what do they got to say? We're coming for your daughter. We're coming for you. I mean, what would bring it home for people that haven't? I know you have, but what would bring it home for people that haven't woken up to this yet? What would it take? These two images today, it seems to me, again, you didn't need to see them to know we had a problem, but it seems to me anybody that was on the fence or didn't, you know, couldn't decide or thought, well, I think Biden is still giving it his best shot. I mean, you've got to see now where we're really at. By the way, speaking of fences, when I look at that video of storming the wire, remember when we were told, and not just by Democrats, people like Will Hurd. Remember Will Hurd? Walls don't work. Fences don't work. It's funny how people in politics, people in the elites, still use fences and walls. They live and work behind them. They put them between you and them. Yet, they don't work. Well, in that video I saw, they would have worked. They would have helped. And there wasn't a wall there. You got to start believing what you see with your own eyes, not this nonsense talk that people are giving you, people that don't live through it and don't live with it and aren't affected by it and are making the rules for the rest of us. So we'll talk about that today. 210-599-5555. Now there's a thing called the World Happiness Report, which rates the relative happiness and satisfaction of about 140-something countries in the world. And you may be interested to know that the United States is falling in the rankings of happy nations. We're down 8 positions to number 23 in this year's World Happiness Survey. If you're wondering, the happiest country in the world is Finland. And they have an interesting theory as to why that is. And the most unhappy place in the world is Afghanistan, which that sounds about right. But what's different about the United States in this ranking compared to a lot of other countries is that in most countries, when you look at the distribution of happiness by age, the younger people are, the happier they are. And in the United States, it's people under 30 who are the most unhappy. The opposite of most countries. The young people are the unhappy Americans. Why do you think that is? Why are young people unhappy? They say in the survey they feel less supported by family and friends, more stressed and less satisfied with their life choices. People under 30 say they have less confidence in government, more perception of corruption. Older people are now happier than younger people in America. Why do you think that is? I want to talk about that. I mean, one thing that seems pretty obvious is that older people are the ones that have money and houses and stuff that's paid for. And surprisingly, I don't mean to sound shallow, but that, not that that makes you happy, but that makes it easier to be happy. That puts your mind at ease. I mean, I'm not trying to be shallow Hal, but when you aren't worrying about living paycheck to paycheck, when you're not worrying about being underwater or having more car than you should or more house than you should or just worrying that you can't afford a house. I know young people that don't even have a house and they're more stressed out than I am. I'm a homeowner, but they're even more stressed out than I am because they feel like they should have a house and it's eating at them that they don't and they can't. And of course, older people have that stuff generally, usually, right? Older people, I think, also grew up with an America that didn't tell them they were racist and evil, that didn't try to divorce them from their God and their parents and their values. They grew up in an America that told them you're in the best place on earth, and they believed it, and they were. And young people, by comparison, have been told that they are racist, that they are guilty. I don't mean like somebody's making them feel guilty. I mean they're taught that they're guilty of systemic racism, that they're living on the shoulders of slavery and stolen land. And when you're from a very young age, you are told that you're evil and the basis of everything you have and have been given is evil. I don't know, but I would think that might work on you a little bit. And today's young people have only known geriatric, corrupt politicians. They have never seen an American democracy that, as Teddy Roosevelt famously said, does a few things vigorously and well. They have never seen an America that is not crouched in the fetal position on the world stage, apologizing for everything, accepting blame for things it didn't do, not getting credit for things it does do and has done. They don't know the history of a great country. They, again, know the history of a country that's the world's villain. They believe that the planet itself is dying. I mean, I've always wondered, how do young people make sense of looking ahead, looking forward over, you know, I'm going to live another 75 years when they're told the planet only has 8 years? Like, what? We didn't have that hanging over us, right? There might have been a few crazies that were worrying about population growth or population bomb or the world might run out of oil by 1980. But when I was growing up in the 70s, we thought we had a whole lifetime ahead of us. And so did the planet. That's not what young people are told today. So little wonder, I think, that, I mean, and you may have even better reasons than those, but I think those are a few of the reasons why, probably, in this survey, young people are so unhappy. By the way, Finland, happiest country in the world for the 7th year in a row. Somebody went there and asked people in Finland why, what makes Finns so happy? And Finns were surprised themselves. They didn't think they were the happiest country. You know what they think it is? Finland has 4,500 trees per person. And according to this article I read, the Finnish people spend a lot of time in the forests, in the woods, in the outdoors, and it makes them happy. I wonder if it's that simple. I mean, they have all the other stuff. You could say, well, is it smartphones? They have them. You know, is it modern technology? They have it. Is it all the angst and trouble in the world? They know about it. We have trees too. I guess their trees are making them happy. Maybe there's more to it. Or maybe that really is it. Over 100 illegal immigrants rushing through razor wire, knocking down guards, illegally crossing the El Paso border. A video that's gone viral today. And at the same time, a Venezuelan national who's in Ohio, who has over 500,000 followers on TikTok, telling people how to invade American homes and invoke squatters' rights. And while I'm thinking of those two things and I'm putting those two things together in my mind, I'm like putting them split screen, you know, side by side. We have this survey of the happiest countries in the world. and the United States is 23rd, which I guess isn't bad, but it's down a lot. And we have this phenomenon of what's driving the falling ranking is the unhappiness of the youngest Americans. So what do you think about that? Why do you think that is, or do you question that that's what it is? 210-599-5555. I mean, obviously I have some ideas, but I think there could be even better explanations for it, and I'd love to hear those from you if you have them. The three happiest countries in the world, Finland, Denmark, and Iceland. All kind of in the same general part of the world, I guess. Maybe there's something to that. I don't know. Maybe it's a regional thing. Maybe it's that cold, crisp air, which I don't know. But I mean, it would be worth looking at if we do it for everything else in just about every other way, on just about every other issue. We look at ourselves vis-a-vis the progress or the achievements of other countries, right? We do it with education and healthcare and obviously economics. We're very competitive people, you know, so what do they got? What are they doing? Is it the trees? Story says they find a lot of happiness in their forests. So I don't know. Isn't that how kind of Teddy Roosevelt helped himself when he was a young man and he was very sickly and had a lot of tragedy in his life? Remember, he went out to the Dakotas and got into the wilderness and walked around in the forests and rode horses and stuff like that. And he says regained his physical and mental well-being, you know? And I mean, we have all these, every third ad on television is for a product that's supposed to give you more energy and make you feel younger and all that. But maybe the old things are the best things. Maybe the ways people used to find vitality and recovery, you know, remember in the olden days, people would move from a city to the countryside, or they would move from the Northeast, which was cold and damp, to, you know, the Southwest, which was dry and warm and sunny. I mean, who knows? We may find out that all the old ways were more restorative and better for the soul than all this new stuff. I mean, maybe you can't make yourself happy with something that's in a blend jet. I don't know. So we'll throw that out there. 210-599-5555. This was a pretty funny moment during the testimony of Tony Bobulinski yesterday. Now, he's the former Hunter Biden business associate who's testifying before the House Oversight Committee in the preliminaries to impeaching President Biden. And the subject of his testimony and that of other people was the Biden family business, which is the peddling of influence and selling of the brand, as they call it, of then former Vice President Joe Biden. He has this encounter with AOC where she tries to skewer him. She tries to gotcha Tony Bobulinski. And this is what it sounded like, cut number five.
Is it your testimony today that you personally witnessed President Joe Biden commit a crime?
I believe the fact that he was sitting with me while I was putting together a business
deal. Did you witness the president commit a crime? Is it your testimony today?
Yes.
And what crime do you have you witnessed?
How much time do I have to go through it?
It is simple. You name the crime. Did you watch him steal something?
Corruption statutes, RICO and conspiracy.
What is it? What is the crime, sir? Specifically.
You asked me to answer the question. I answered the question. No. RICO, you're obviously not familiar with. Corruption
Excuse
statute.
Me, sir. Excuse Aura. Me, sir. Excuse me, sir. RICO is not a crime. It is a category. What is
it's
the
It's a category
crime?
Of crimes that you then charge
You
under
have charges.
A long 100
You have charges. Sir, please
you want me to
name
the exact statute
sir?
Under RICO?
Yes. Oh,
well, it's funny. In this committee room, everyone's not here. There's over 18
All right, sir. I reclaim my
lawyers
time.
That went to law school.
Time. I
I'll
reclaim
leave
my
it
time.
To you guys
okay,
to
thank
define
you,
the
sir.
Statute.
I reclaim my time.
She reclaims her time. That's how you get out of it now. You say, I reclaim my time. If you get into an argument with somebody and you're losing, you know, like you're fighting with your husband or something, just shout at him that you reclaim your time. By the way, as an aside, what you just heard right there the dynamic between him and her, and I know people aren't going to like me saying this, but I'm going to say it. This is why Trump has to appoint a female running mate. Because every time you put a male politician in a debate with a female opponent, and in the vice presidential debate, that's going to be Kamala Harris. Every time, the man defers to the woman. The man allows the woman to talk over him and interrupt him. It's ingrained in our psyche. I don't care who you are. I don't care what you are. It's impossible for men not to do that, and they do it. And he lets her talk right over him. He tells her the answer to the question. RICO. RICO's a law. Yes, it's a category of crimes. But if you're saying RICO's not a crime, that's what she says, right? RICO are the charges against Trump in Georgia. The federal prisons are full of people that were convicted on RICO cases. And then he says FARA, which is foreign, I forget the exact acronym, but it's failure to register as a foreign agent. And of course, the very clear implication of Joe Biden being in the conversations and phoning into and parachuting into the conversations that Hunter Biden is having with these people, whether they're from China, Ukraine, what have you, is that the Biden family business is profiting to the tune of tens of millions of dollars from strategic opponents, corrupt individuals, entities around the world. There are no goods or services being delivered. There is no consulting being done. Hunter Biden is a dolt. He is letting them know, I can get you into, look, I am getting you into the big guy. That's the answer. And he answered it. I mean, he did okay, but he had a hard time with it because AOC's a woman. And you can be as mad as you want at me about that. And I get angry email every time. I usually like you. I usually agree with you. I can't believe you said that. I'm right. And you see it in debate after debate after debate. So, Mr. Trump, if you're listening, if you want the VP debate to not be a series of Vice President Harris going, I'm talking, I'm not finished, excuse me. If you don't want that to happen, find yourself a very sharp woman as your running mate, and she will not take that. You put any guy in there, and he will. Tell me I'm wrong. Growing up in the 70s and 80s, I kind of saw, you know, a couple of extremes as far as America's place in the world. I mean, the mid and late 70s were not a good time, you know. You had the aftermath of the Vietnam War. You had the malaise years. You had Carter. You had the Iranian hostage crisis. On the other hand, in the 80s, you had Morning in America and Ronald Reagan, ebullient, confident, assertive, pro-America leadership, confident confrontation with the communist world leading to a peaceful end in the Cold War rather than, you know, nuclear winter. So I saw all of that in a very compressed amount of time during what might have been the most impressionable years of my life. If you're around my age, you know what I'm talking about. Through all of that, not that anyone I think ever asked me, but if they had, I would have said I live in the greatest country on earth. I believed that. I knew that was true. I didn't guess it. And if you had told me, well, no, actually you and your age group are really unhappy, I wouldn't have believed that. I wouldn't have had any evidence of that or been able to relate to that. What do you think is going on? I mean, first of all, do you think our 23rd ranking in the world is too high, too low, or just about right? And why would young people today be melancholy and down compared to older Americans? Now, you may be hearing that thinking, I don't know about that, Jack, because I'm older and I'm worried about the country and I'm depressed about the politicians. But just bear in mind, even though you see that and you're worried about that stuff, you also remember more. You have more of a foundation to put that on. And part of why you don't like, you look at the border and you go, it's gone to hell. But part of the reason you think that is because you remember when that wasn't true. But if you're young, say you're, you know, 18, you really don't remember a time when this was not a subject of consternation and concern. And, you know, I think we have to be fair and say, all right, these are not just, you know, crybabies. They really have not had the benefit of what we had the benefit of. What do you think? 210-599-5555. There is an interesting thing going on I was reading about today with Donald Trump and big donors. Now, as you probably know, and it's not something that politicians like to talk about, what really drives presidential campaigns, it's not the $5 and $25 you send to your favorite candidate. It's really the mother's milk of running for president, which is a hundreds of millions of dollars enterprise, is big donors, bundlers, corporate donors. And this article was saying that there are these millionaire and billionaire would-be donors to the Trump campaign. By the way, I'm not saying all millionaires and billionaires support Trump, because a lot of them are Democrats and support Biden, but there are these people that would or are considering or want to donate to Trump, but they're not. The reason they're not is Letitia James. Because they're wondering if her ruse stands up, if she is able to succeed in seizing assets and collecting $500 million from Trump, what does that mean for people that support Trump? What does that mean if you are a real estate developer, if you have holdings, if you do business in or are headquartered in New York? Could you be next? And Trump is saying he, you know, can't post this bond that he needs to post to appeal the verdict. I'm wondering if we maybe are missing the whole point of this, that the actions against Trump in New York are not just to hurt him or embarrass him or impoverish him, but they are really designed to make sure that he is radioactive to people that normally and routinely write big checks. Like, we're talking about fundraising events where people spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to go and get their picture taken or have a dinner. And it's credible to me, I'm not saying that I know anybody like this, but it's credible to me that somebody would say, well, wait a minute, what am I exposing myself to if I take that step, if I make that move, if I'm on that list? Now, you would like to think that people would just do what they believe is right and, you know, damn the torpedoes, and probably some people do. But there probably are also careful people, people whose convictions are not that strong. They kind of prefer Trump or something about him, but not so strongly that they want to wind up on Letitia James' radar. And I realize when I say this that you may be thinking, well, wait a minute, Jack. She can't just make this case against anybody. But actually, legal experts say she can. That there really isn't much to this other than invoking a very old law that was never used the way she's using it, and basing it on the overvaluing, sort of braggadocio overvaluing, of real estate, something that a lot of people do. that we're told, in fact, by Kevin O'Leary, almost everyone in the New York real estate world does. So if you're in that world and you're capable of writing that check, but you know this is the regulatory atmosphere right now, maybe you don't. And starving him of money is a big part of the strategy. You know, you may think, oh, well, they're just trying to dirty him up or put him in prison. The way you get Trump is to give Joe Biden and the Democrats a massive financial advantage, which they currently have, to maintain the structure of elections as they were in 2020, which they have currently done, to spread fear porn about he's a dictator, bloodbath, he'll put you all in chains, he's, you know, he has dire plans if he gets back in, which they're doing. I mean, these are the things. You can take any poll you want, you can feel good about the numbers and what's happening in the battleground states, but the things that give them an advantage right now, the money, the fear porn, the structure of elections, those are all in place. Those are all quietly sitting there waiting to help the improbable reelection of Joe Biden. And Chad is on the show. Chad, welcome.
Hey, thank you so much for taking my call, Jack. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for calling. I sure can.
Oh, okay, perfect. So here's what I was going to say about Letitia James going after Donald Trump and stuff, right? So not only is it a personal attack on Trump, but they realize that he represents a large swath of the American people, right? So they're setting a precedent to say, hey, look, we don't like him and his politics, and you by association, we don't like you and your politics. So guess what we're going to do? We're going to come after you and bankrupt you as well. Right. And unfortunately, we don't have the type of backing monetarily in order to fight against the machine. Right. So what are they going to do? They're going to effectively silence us by taking all of our voting power, which is money, away from us.
You know, I actually think you can silence people by doing nothing. All you have to do is make people afraid of raising their head over the edge of the trench. I mean, if they just worry that associating with Trump, being on a list of donors, writing a positive tweet, or you know, putting a sign in their yard, whatever, if they just worry that association could be costly or incriminating, people just won't do it.
Yeah, even just donating to Trump. On the same token, right? They're keeping lists of those individuals who are donating to him $5, $10, $20, $100, $200. It doesn't matter, right? Oh, you're guilty by association, which is the precedent that they're trying to set in the court of law by saying, hey, look, Trump's guilty of this, and therefore you, by donating to him, are guilty by association.
You're in on it. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you're in on it.
You made a donation to a criminal enterprise.
Exactly. And therefore, hey, well, then the RICO statutes might then apply to you, right? Because if they determine that he's a criminal enterprise and you're donating to that criminal enterprise, therefore you are part of the racketeering scheme.
Yeah.
And we're going to come after you and we're going to round you up and put you into re-education camps.
I got it. And I think you're onto something there, Chad. I really think, and it's very simple, as you said. It doesn't require anything but people worrying a little, not being sure, gray area. Maybe I better not. That's really all you have to do. And then you can't really accuse them of anything. They didn't do anything. They just created an atmosphere where people wondered if. I've told this story before. I've never donated to a political campaign. But one time when I was covering a political convention, it was the Republican convention in 2012, I bought a shirt at the gift store. They had like a pop-up gift store. And it was just a cool shirt. It didn't have a candidate on it or a slogan or anything. It's just a t-shirt. That was it. And from that purchase, I have watched and been fascinated by the quantity and variety of lists that I have gotten onto for solicitation of donations and other causes, and not just the Republicans. And a lot of times there's a reference to, we know that you gave in 2012, or we know that you, you know, once. So I'm thinking to myself, people know that that information is everywhere. And of course it's fine. I don't care. But I could see where somebody who had a lot to lose, which I don't, who's capable of making a substantial donation, which I can't, would feel like, I have a lot to lose if I want to be associated with that guy. Given the radio station this morning for a meeting and some studio work, and now I've been in radio now, this is the 40th year that I've been in radio. When I started in radio, you're young and you're excited and you can't believe it. You made the team. You want to be there all the time. I was there all the time. I'd come early, stay late. I'd find stuff to do. I'd overdo what I was supposed to do, you know, just, and there were a lot of people. You know, you could have one or two radio stations in the building and be like 100 people. Like every other workplace in America, it's very different now. I hear this from people all the time. Workplaces have changed because they're not the workplace. The work is not in the workplace. It's a huge change. It really is. It's funny how it was about 4 years ago right now, right? 4 years ago, mid-March, late March, that we were shutting everything down. We were invoking all of these emergency temporary things. It was 4 years ago that one of our station engineers came out to the house and we duct taped cables to the floor because you're going to be doing your show here a couple of weeks till this COVID thing, the flatten the curve, 14 days, you know, okay. We're taping stuff temporary. Just throw it over there, throw it over here. It's just going to be for a couple of weeks, 4 years. And I'm not just talking about my situation. I mean, workplaces, what that means, big change. We did a lot of stuff really fast that people complied with, I think because they thought it was, they didn't really think about it the way you would think about it if somebody said, hey, from now on, this is what you're going to do, or this is how you will work, or this is how you will be. If people had said it to you that way, hey, we're changing everything permanently, how different that would have been and how different people's reaction or compliance with that would have been. But you see, they didn't say that. And no one really knew that. I'm not blaming anybody in our company. I mean, we all thought it was a couple of weeks. And workplaces have changed. And therefore people's lives have changed. And when you think about COVID, and maybe you do go to work now, or maybe you never stopped going to work. I realize this doesn't apply to everybody, but my point is, when you think about the COVID changeover, it's always interesting to me how cooperative and compliant people were, and yet, nevertheless, the branch Covidian tyrants started in with their mandates and their orders and their, you know, emergency powers. And, you know, yes, eventually people chafed and questioned and revolted, and rightly so. But I don't think we should forget that in the beginning, there was that kind of, we're all in the boat together. What do I need to do? We would have, Don Cooper, you remember this, we would have a doctor on the show. We were doing 4 and 5 hour shows, and we would have an hour of Q&A with a doctor, and they would tell you what you could do and not do, and what would be helpful and not helpful, and did you need to wipe down your groceries before you brought them in the house, and all this stuff. And people weren't, you know, people were genuinely interested, like, tell me what I need to know, you know? And what it shows us is that there was an immediate default to giving orders and making mandates. It wasn't that people didn't want to stay healthy, cooperate, get through this. They did. There was a spirit of that that was, you know, sort of like we've seen at other moments in American history. We're all in this together. And they ruined that. The little tyrants and tin horn dictators and wannabe Napoleons ruined that by making everything mandatory, by making the concept of, hey, I'm just trying to do the right thing, look like it was weakness, look like it was surrender. And so eventually, remember how people got very militant about, like, if you were wearing a mask, you were a Democrat, and if you weren't, you were a Trump vote. You know, I mean, it's just that kind of thing was their creation. And never forget that they did it, and never forget that the people who did it on the basis of nothing, because every one of those supposed concepts and precepts has been walked back. Everything that was a conspiracy theory is now a clarification, right? Just remember, those, all of those people still in positions of power and authority and never called to reckoning for it, never asked to come on the carpet and correct it, apologize for it. No one's fallen on their sword, etc. So 210-599-5555. This was, I thought, kind of interesting. The people at OutKick found this. Google, over the weekend, changed the definition of the word bloodbath. Remember that former President Trump gave the speech in Ohio about the auto industry, or it was a speech about many things, but in talking about the auto industry, said, this is what China is doing. I will stop them. If you reelect Biden, it will be a bloodbath, meaning for the auto industry. And it was clear from the context, and we played it, that that's what he was saying. And there's been this attempt to generate the idea that he is threatening the country with a bloodbath if he's not put back in office. So if you were to go to Google last week and look for the definition of bloodbath, it would be, it would read as follows: a ruthless slaughter of a great number of people, massacre, a period of disastrous loss or reversal. And the example sentence was, a few mutual funds performed well in the general bloodbath of the stock market. If you were to go today, the definition of Google is, I'm sorry, the definition of bloodbath on Google is, an event or situation in which many people are killed in a violent manner. And the example sentence is, he allowed the protest to go ahead despite warnings that it would spark a bloodbath. And Google is, I think, in all this attention on banning TikTok or worry about who controls TikTok, I'm sorry, but Google is a much bigger deal. 99% of everything we do goes through Google. I mean, everything we do on the internet. You know, think about how often you hear about something and then you Google it. Think about how many places where you've read a story, read an article, tried to find out if something was true. Where did you start? That's where you started. The fact is that Google has exponentially more control and, if you will, leadership over what people know and how people find things out than TikTok will ever have. And so it's a much greater threat for election interference than any other platform. It's over 90% of the search engine market. And they say that something like 97 or 98% of Google users only look at the first page of results when they search something. Like you're looking for a guy to build a fence, or you're looking for the nearest, pizza restaurant or you're looking for, you know, whatever it is, people usually don't go past the first page. So the way Google ranks and throttles response and what people see is hugely influential. They used to say the front page of the newspaper was the agenda setter for our society. It's really the front page of Google that is now. Google decides which stories you should and should not see on a topic. When you look at something up and the results pop up, what you don't think about is what isn't there. I notice it because I'm doing this all day. I'm always fascinated by how there's almost never the FoxNews.com version of any story. And yet it's one of the most viewed digital platforms in the news space. So I realize they don't have the reputation and they don't have the polarizing effect in a debate that like Facebook and people see Mark Zuckerberg and they have very strong feelings one way or the other. And obviously right now TikTok, everybody's hyped up about TikTok, but there's something quietly, facelessly kind of looming about Google. Like if Google didn't exist, it would be something that like an Orwellian dystopian writer, you know, would have to invent. So talking about that video that's gone viral today, over 100 illegal immigrants trying to enter the country illegally, just sort of mass up and rush a border, fence. There's like wire, plunging through the razor wire, knocking over the U.S. personnel. It's several hundred that did it, but it's over 100 that got into the country before Texas National Guard took control. It's emerging that some of the hesitation was due to the number of children who were in that group. And I think that video is a very stark and eloquent response to all the politicians and pundits who wagged their fingers at us over the years and said, walls don't work and barriers don't work and you need to do smart enforcement because you can't do it the way Trump is saying or proposing or trying to do it. And admittedly, you have to do a lot of things. Of course, you have to walk and chew gum at the same time, but these are exactly the situations where any kind of fence or wall would have given authorities a little more time and a little more cushion to push back. And we know that the people that said that don't believe what they said because they themselves live and work behind fences and walls all the time. And then the other video that we've been talking about is this Venezuelan national who made a TikTok urging people, in fact, promising to set up a business where he will teach people how to come into the country and squat in unoccupied homes, taking advantage of laws that favor so-called squatters' rights, and that you should come here and do that, and he's going to set up a business that teaches people how to do it based on the laws of that state. He's in Ohio. So, and remember yesterday I said, why doesn't somebody else have an SB4? I mean, I know that Texas is still going through the process of litigation over whether or not the law can be enforced, which allows local police to detain and initiate deportment of people in the country illegally. Well, now the state of Iowa has a bill called Senate Bill 2340 that is very similar to SB4. It's passed the Iowa Senate. It is in the Iowa House. And then if passed, it would go to the governor, Kim Reynolds' desk. She has said she will sign it, and it will take effect July 1 if she does. She is saying that, as Greg Abbott did, we have to do this. States have to step in because President Biden and his administration have failed to enforce our immigration laws. Now, think of this moment. Iowa. I mean, I don't know, but I'm thinking probably in years past, immigration was not a big topic of conversation in Iowa, a big political hot-button issue in Iowa. It's not an exaggeration when people say they've made every state a border state. There are similar bills in New Hampshire, Tennessee, and Oklahoma. And SB 4 was signed into law in December, but has been in the courts ever since. 210-599-5555. We were talking about the woman in Alaska who was, I guess, thrown out isn't the right word. I guess she had her membership canceled by Planet Fitness because she complained about a man in the woman's locker room. Do you remember, like, in the old days, if in a movie or a television show, a man went into a women's bathroom or the changing room at a department store, remember he would get chased out by a bunch of angry women? They'd be yelling and screaming, and they'd be hitting him with their purses and umbrellas. They had big purses, and they had umbrellas. And the guy would be lucky to escape with his life for going into the woman's restroom. It even happened in cartoons, you know? I mean, Daffy Duck. And it was, you know, not controversial. It was bipartisan. Everybody agreed, this guy's a creep. We have gone from that to punishing the woman who notices the man in her locker room. Shaming and canceling the woman as if she's in the wrong place. And we do it in the name of making everyone comfortable and accommodated. But what about girls and women? Why isn't their comfort and their accommodation also a consideration? What if the guy is making them uncomfortable? Where's the policy on that? And Planet Fitness calls this a judgment-free zone. That really doesn't call this a judgment-free zone. That's their marketing for their workout space. But maybe you need a little judgment. Like, maybe judgment isn't always a bad word. Maybe judgment means being discerning, recognizing that there are things that are right and things that are wrong. You know, I'm sure Planet Fitness has a lot of rules. I'm not a member, but I'm sure they have rules. I'm sure you have to pay a membership to join. And I'm sure if you skip a month, you don't get to go. I'm sure they have hours when they open and close. And if you're late, they don't hang around and stay open later for you. They probably don't let you bring a gun on the premises. I know my gym doesn't allow that. So they have rules. They know how to judge. They could judge here. They're not powerless to do it. And it takes challenging it, and it takes creating that, you know, sort of financial pain, the Bud Light phenomenon. I feel like we can see where this story is going, can't you? They will take a hit. They will suffer. They will lose stock value. They are losing stock value. They'll lose members. I'm sure the meetings have already begun behind closed doors. A certain amount of pain will be absorbed, and then a certain amount of crow will be eaten. And I don't know if this woman ever wants to go back there. Maybe she doesn't. But if she does, I could almost guarantee you she will have a membership, if she wants one, which I would understand if she didn't. And then eventually you hope that they'll stop having to go through the motions of taking the hit. Like, the lesson of Bud Light is don't be Bud Light. Don't go there in the first place. Don't be Planet Fitness. Don't go there in the first place. 210-599-5555. We need some judgment. And maybe some big purses, too.
It is now time. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the final countdown. Music.
I love it. Music.
Top 10 board. We'll start with number 10.
KTSA.
We are in the third week of March 1978. on this Throwback Thursday. And before we count down the top 10 songs from this week, some of the big stories in the news. The former premier of Italy, Aldo Moro, has been kidnapped and killed by Red Brigade terrorists. Police are investigating the attempted shooting death of Larry Flint, the publisher of Hustler magazine. He survives the shooting. The San Diego Padres do something that's never been done in baseball history. They fire their manager, Alvin Dark, during spring training. Happened on this day in 1978. And we are in the midst of the mania for Saturday Night Fever. Five of the top 10 songs this week are productions of the Gibb Brothers. Four of them in the top 10 are from the movie soundtrack. Let's start with the song at number 10, which has nothing to do with Saturday Night Fever or the Gibb Brothers, but is Jay Ferguson's biggest hit. With the Eagles' Joe Walsh on guitar, it reaches number 10 this week. Here's Thunder Island. Jay Ferguson's Thunder Island is at number 10. More recently these days, Jay is writing TV theme music. The song at number 9 reminds us that the Bee Gees this week are 50% of the top 10. Thanks to the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack, they wrote this one. Yvonne Elliman sings it, eventually took it to number 1. For me personally, this is my favorite song on that album, and I just think it's the perfect marriage of a singer and a song. She's perfect, and yet it's amazing to think that this was chosen for her at the last minute. The song she was supposed to sing on that album was How Deep Is Your Love. Of course, the Bee Gees themselves did that one. At number 9 this week, leaping 5 spots, If I Can't Have You by Yvonne Elliman. We go to Canada for the song at number 8 this week. Canadian pop singer-songwriter Dan Hill, who has produced hits for other artists, had his biggest one, Sometimes When We Touch. Dan Hill told me on the Music Magazine in 1988 that he wrote this song several years earlier. He was only 18. He was trying to convince a woman he was dating to be his exclusive girlfriend. It did not work. However, it's a great hit, a huge hit, and Dan Hill is at number 8 this week with Sometimes When We Touch. Singer-songwriter best known for hits like I Go Crazy and Cool Night and Sweet Life is singing his song here at number 7 about a man meeting a long-lost love and realizing he's not over her. It's Paul Davis and I Go Crazy. Huge hit that really has never been off the radio, Paul Davis and I Go Crazy, this week at number 7. Now, a few years later, he had a new record label and tried a new sound, or at least a new sound for him. He wrote a song called 55 Love Affair, but Arista Records felt that they needed to modernize that title because the audience they were going for wasn't really alive in the 50s. Paul Davis himself was only a little kid, so they called it 65 Love Affair. Paul Davis was only 6 years old in 1955, too young for a love affair, but was just the right age in 1965. A bonus song on our countdown, 65 Love Affair by Paul Davis. And now the song at number six this week in 1978 on Throwback Thursday is Barry Gibb's writing. He's the only person in history to write four consecutive number one hits. We're playing all of them on this countdown. We heard If I Can't Have You back at number nine. And right here at number six is another Barry Gibb composition with Andy Gibb, Love Is Thicker Than Water.
Well, I need her more than she needs you. That's what I'm living for.
Andy Gibb at number six this week in 1978, Love Is Thicker Than Water. The song at number five this week in 78 was first recorded by the Carpenters, for whom it was a B-side. This week, with a few lyric changes, Barry Manilow puts it on the A-side and takes it to number five. Here's Can't Smile Without You. The great Barry Manilow will be coming to San Antonio on his farewell tour this summer with the number five hit this week in 78, Can't Smile Without You. Eric Clapton has the number four song this week on our countdown. He's also on a new charity record to raise money for teenage cancer treatment and research. We played it for you the other night. It's called Going Home. But here at number four is Lay Down Sally. And just to prove that the music industry is a very, very small world, Yvonne Elliman, who we heard back at number nine, is singing backup on this song with Eric Clapton, Lay Down Sally, holding on at number four this week in 1978. Well, we told you the Bee Gees had a hard time figuring out who would sing what on the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack, and they had a different song in mind for this next singer. In fact, they were going to give her Don't Throw It All Away, Our Love. But instead, Samantha Sang sang Emotion.
No.
unforgettable, breathy ballad off the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack, Emotion, by Australia's Samantha Sang. It's almost hard to tell her voice apart from the Bee Gees on that record. Well, the Bee Gees have the top two songs on this week's Top 10 Countdown. The song at number two had been at number one for the entire month of February 1978. At number two, here's Stayin' Alive. This song was a big Grammy winner for the Bee Gees. It's number two this week in 1978, Stayin' Alive. And that sets us up for the number one song this week in 1978.
Number one.
When producer Robert Stigwood was getting ready to title the movie, he wanted to call it Saturday Night. But Robin Gibb expressed hesitation at that title. Stigwood also liked calling the movie Night Fever after the song, but was concerned of marketing a movie with that name. So the compromise was Saturday Night Fever. The number one song this week in 1978 from that soundtrack, Night Fever. For the 5 weeks that Night Fever was at number one, Stayin' Alive was at number two. And for this 1 week in March 1978, the Bee Gees and Bee Gees-related artists held five of the top 10 positions on the Hot 100 and four of the top five positions. This week's number one song, Night Fever by the Bee Gees from 1978. When I put these countdowns together, I always think of when I was starting out in radio, I had this kind of, I don't know, naive idea that I would write to some people that were giants, you know, the biggest names, and see if they would give me advice or encouragement. So I wrote them notes, and I explained to them who I was, and I was just starting out, and did they have anything they could tell me that would be helpful? And two that wrote back very personally and very nicely were Dick Clark and Rick Dees. And both of them were, of course, countdown hosts and nationally syndicated radio people. And I don't remember the Rick Dees letter as well, but it was something along the lines of always be enthusiastic and, you know, be good company for people to listen to. But Dick Clark said something that has always stayed with me. When you're in music radio and you're playing the hits, be positive about the songs and the singers, because people who like that music only want to hear, don't report that so-and-so was arrested or, you know, so it got a DUI or so and so. Just be positive. Sound like you love the music. If you do love it, let that sound, you know, come through in your voice. If not, act it out and be very positive about the artist, because these songs and these singers mean a lot to your listeners. He really took the time to put all this in the form of a letter. It was very detailed and it was personal. It had his signature on it. And, I'll never forget that. And it was good advice, by the way, which also made it unforgettable. And you wonder today, you know, like, would people that famous and on top of their industry, even would they even get a letter from a guy like me, much less take the time to answer it? I don't know. Write to Christian Blood and see if that happens. In the 22 years that this survey was taken, the United States ranked in the top 10 or top 20 every year until this year. It's the survey called the World Happiness Report. It sounds like I'm making that up, but I'm not. And in the latest World Happiness Report, the United States tumbles to number 23, still pretty good among 143 ranked countries. But the drop in ranking is driven by Americans becoming increasingly pessimistic about everything from the country's political leadership to loneliness to the economy to technology. And the worst sort of, I guess you could say, funk is with Americans under the age of 30 feeling worse about their lives. That cost America in this survey. Today's young people say they feel less supported by family and friends, less free to make life choices, which seems odd to me because it would seem like just the opposite would be true. More stressed, less satisfied with their living conditions, their jobs. They feel less confident in government and in leaders and in institutions. They feel there's more corruption or they're more aware of it. They, in fact, are now the least happy among us, whereas in most countries, the older a person was, the less happy they were. In this country, older Americans are the ones most likely to be happy with their circumstances and their outlook. Why do you think it's like this? How do you explain this? What do you think about this? 210-599-5555. And by the way, the happiest country in the world, according to the survey, is Finland. And that came as a surprise even to Finland, because they didn't think of it that way. But they've been number one on this survey for about 6 or 7 years. And one article I read said that they attribute it to the beautiful forests and the amount of time that Finns spend out of doors. They're very outdoorsy people. They walk around in their woods and forests, and they draw breaths of fresh forest air, and it invigorates them and makes them feel less stressed about work and money and family and stuff like that. So, okay, all right. Is there something we can learn from that, or what do we do about our situation? What do you think? I do think when you look at, you know, sort of like baby boomers versus Gen Z, baby boomers to Gen Zers, baby boomers all look very rich. You know, nice house, nice car, cars, stuff's paid for. There's no debt. There's economic security. And even if you're not a materialistic person, you know that when you don't have those worries, Ramsey talks a lot about this, right? When you're not stressed about, when you have a cushion or a comfort zone about money, even if money's not really important to you, you're just more relaxed. You have a better outlook on other things. The things that are important to you are now more somehow available to you. Whereas if money is a worry, if money is tight, it can make your marriage unhappy. It can make you feel like you're not moving forward. I talk to young people a lot who angst and schwitz about, I should own a house. Why don't I own a house? Why am I still living with my parents? And stuff like that. So I can see where to young people, older people look like they have it made. It's a very strange thing to me because we live in a culture that worships youth. We live in a culture where older people, not necessarily you, but, you know, a lot of older people are constantly trying to look younger. And yet young people think that older people are the ones with all the money and all the stuff, and they're not completely wrong about that. So what's happening with our happiness? I want to talk about that. 210-599-5555. You know, if you're a young person, if you're Gen Z, you have grown up with, corrupt geriatric political leaders. You have grown up with a relentlessly propagandistic culture. You can't go to a movie. You can't go to a concert. You can't watch a television show. You can't just entertain yourself, watch sports, without getting a political lecture. The entertainment culture has become the activism culture. Everything now apparently is a political rally, right? And if you're a student, K through 12 or college, you are forced to watch videos and sit through curricula teaching you that all white people are racist, teaching you that you're living and going to school on stolen land, teaching you that the country is corrupt and based on corruption and always has been. It's kind of a wonder that anybody in that generation would ever be positive, optimistic, secure, confident. Haven't we done just about everything you can possibly do to make sure that doesn't happen? You and I grew up hearing that it was the greatest country on earth. Most of us believed that. I believe that. They have never heard that, unless they hear it from you. 210-599-5555. I think, even, you know, like the talk about the planet, we tell young people today, my daughter would come home from school and ask me why there was only going to be, you know, 8 years left for Earth, or how come we were only going to have Earth for 10 more years or whatever. It was always a different number. And you break it down and explain this is a viewpoint. This is not a fact. This is not science. But, when you stop and think about it, it's easy for us to be sort of comically dismissive of that stuff. But if kids are sitting in classrooms where the taught science is, if we don't do something in 10 years, goodbye Earth, or goodbye human life on Earth, or goodbye coastline, you know, somehow I would think that would kind of filter in and get into the, you know, the brain cells and the sinews of the person, and you're growing. And remember, Rush used to call young people skulls full of mush, you know? So yeah, I mean, if you start to take this thing apart, and I mean, this is my answer, but it may not be your answer. I can kind of see where young people would be not feeling great about things. And maybe they don't do that in every country. I don't think in Finland they teach those youngsters that they're racists. There might be something to that, you know? 210-599-5555. There was a story in the Wall Street Journal 2 weeks ago, or 3 weeks ago. Is politics making kids depressed? Is progressive politics not beneficial for mental health? And it was looking at some disturbing data about how nearly 3 out of 5 high school girls in the United States report feelings of persistent sadness or hopelessness, which is a huge increase over the past, that both high school boys and girls are experiencing more mental health challenges or reporting them, reporting record high levels of sexual violence, of suicidal thoughts and risk, persistent feelings of hopelessness. This was from a survey that had been done over a 10-year period of 9th to 12th graders across the country. And while most of us are mainly worried about our kids, you know, our children, our child, you got to kind of think about the world, the waters they're swimming in, right? I think the lockdowns were very deleterious and disastrous for this generation. It probably made what was already a trend worse. But I think, and this article goes on to say, it seems to also be specific to politics, that there seems to be a correlation in these numbers with the period of time that progressives have been, teaching that everything is bad. Bad for you, bad for the planet. And if you think about it, and I know I'm wildly generalizing here, But kids that are raised in a conservative household or go to a private school or are not maybe just exposed to as much of this seem on average to be less subject to these trends, seem to have a little bit more self-esteem. I started noticing more than 10 years ago when we would do shows about homeschooling and we would have homeschool families come in and they'd bring the kid or the kids. We did a lot of this in the studio back when I was on Into the Night. And everybody around me noticed it. Our producers noticed it. These kids were noticeably happier. And they smiled and they laughed and they looked you in the eye when they talked to you. And I don't know. Maybe it's a good idea to not fill the heads of children with rising sea levels and, you know, holes in the ozone layer and, the impending death of mammals, because they can't do anything about it anyway, even if you believe that's coming. Maybe you let them learn and grow up. And then if you want to appeal to them as voters, that's a different story. But we start very young on the whole, you know, propagandizing, activating, young people. And it, you know, you think of Greta, it probably does a number on them. They don't have the resilience or the ability to balance it that we do. So anyway, I want to talk about that. 210-599-5555. Do you think that's a fair share of the blame? Is it social media? Is it technology? What do you think? It's a big subject. I do have to say, I mean, I grew up with going through the Carter and then Reagan presidencies. So, it wasn't all great Mount Rushmore-level leaders. But, again, if you're coming of age right now, Biden, Pelosi, Schumer, with the Republicans, you've got Speaker of the Month Club, and I don't know. I think it's probably the more I've thought about this today, the more I've thought, yeah, I can see. We can see where the pessimism or the, I guess, low spirits might come from. Anyway, 210-599-5555. Joe Biden has a history of saying some pretty crazy things about race and some pretty dumb things. And they are trying to get him out more into media spaces where he can get to, you know, Hispanic and black audiences. They have him doing a lot of local radio. Here he is on a radio station in Milwaukee with an African-American format, talk format, and host. And I want you to hear this ridiculous comment that he makes. Cut number three.
I want to make it clear to you that, now, first of all, I tell you the truth. And I'm not being facetious when I say that. I've never, in the fact checks by you in the press, pointed out this guy is misrepresented so much.
He also talked about how families that are poor don't have books in the home. Cut number six, I think it is, Don.
For example, you know, how many black communities are in a situation where they come from a circumstance where they're in difficulty, where the families are in real trouble, where you have people who, you know, how many, even those families that are really poor don't have any books in the house. The kids don't hear a whole lot of conversation.
They don't have books in the house and they don't hear conversation. What's going on in these houses? How does Joe Biden know that? How would he know that? Where is he getting that from? Now, a lot of people were reminded of Biden 4 years ago in the 2020 debates with the other Democratic candidates, where he actually said that in order to help these parents, you should turn on the record player. Listen to this, cut number 7.
Responsible to pay for what happened 300 years ago. You said that some 40 years ago. But as you stand here tonight, what responsibility do you think that Americans need to take to repair the legacy of slavery in our country?
Well, they have to deal with the look, there is institutional segregation in this country. And from the time I got involved, I started dealing with that. Redlining, banks, making sure that we are in a position where, look, we talk about education. I propose that what we take is those very poor schools, the Title I schools, triple the amount of money we spend from $15 to $45 billion a year. Give every single teacher a raise, an equal raise of getting out the $60,000 level. Number two, make sure that we bring in to help the student, the teachers deal with the problems that come from home. The problems that come from home, we have one school psychologist for every 1,500 kids in America today. It's crazy. The teachers are, and I'm married to a teacher. My deceased wife is a teacher. They have every problem coming to them. We have to make sure that every single child does, in fact, have 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds go to school. School, not daycare. School. We bring social workers into homes of parents to help them deal with how to raise their children. It's not that they don't want to help. They don't know quite what to do. Play the radio. Make sure the television, make sure you have the record player on at night. The phone. Make sure the kids hear words. A kid coming from a very poor school, or a very poor background, will hear 4 million words fewer spoken by the time they get there. There's
Thank
so
you, Mr.
much.
Vice President.
No, I'm going to go like the rest of them do, twice over, okay?
It's like a weird combination of very specific facts that he probably has memorized or has written down, and sort of an angry, filibustery, I'm going to string all this together, I'm going to embed these statistics. Because in the course of normal conversation, people don't go, hey, did you know that poor kids hear 4 million fewer words? I mean, I don't even know what that means. Like, I don't even know what to make of that. I'm not even sure what that means or if that's even true. But when you listen to politicians like President Biden, you realize that one of the ways we differ from them is that everything he's describing points to the need for government spending and government programs. And when he says we, it always means the government. It always means his administration. There is no distinction between we, the people, and we, the government. Everything that is done is the government. If something isn't being done, it's because the government isn't doing it. And if the government doesn't do something, it doesn't get done. That's always what we means when politicians like Joe Biden talk. One of the biggest differences between us and them is that we're capable of appreciating that something might be true and real and need to be addressed, but that it doesn't necessarily need to be addressed by the government. It may not be best addressed by the government. We're able to conceive of a situation where people choose, decide, come together, and act. That there might be other forces in our lives, other groupings of people or alliances or meetings of the mind, right? And it doesn't have to be, and you might not want it to be the government. It's easy to get distracted by the sort of weird non sequiturs about putting on the record player, which really shows his age. I mean, I guess what I hear though is a man that believes the only action comes from government. The only virtue comes from government. That government must go into people's homes and teach them how to raise their children. The problem with kids these days, he thinks, is they haven't had enough government. You and I look at this and we say, the problem these days is they've had too much. They have too much. There is too much. And there's more coming. You look out every window and there's more government coming. It's coming into your community. It's coming into your neighborhood. It's coming into your schools. It's coming into your home. It's coming into the brains of your children, which is why they're so sad and worried and anxious. I don't hear anybody saying we need more government, but I hear a lot of people saying, would they just back off? Would they just get out of our business? It's a big difference. It's getting bigger all the time. It was funny, in one of those interviews, Biden also claimed that Trump is against birthright citizenship, and he tells the interviewer that if there was if Trump ended birthright citizenship, he says to the guy, neither you nor I would be here. And Joe Biden is not an immigrant or the child of immigrants. I mean, it really is not credible to me that he just gets confused because he has a stammer or because he has dementia. He also is a serial liar. He will be corrected by, even when he's corrected by the media, which is rare, or by his staff, he cannot let go of stuff that sounds good to him. And it's overwhelming. It's like you can't, there's so many, you can't keep track of them or keep them straight. But yeah, I mean, that's a whopper. That Joe Biden is the child of immigrants and would not be in America if there was not for birthright citizenship. Do we have that? I forgot we had that. Let's play that. Cut number four.
I call for Pathway for Citizens for Dreamers, and other guys try to terminate DACA that wants to end the birthright citizenship, which is ridiculous. Look, to end the birthright citizenship, you and I wouldn't be citizens. I wouldn't be a citizen. So the point is that it's crazy what they're trying to do, but there's a lot we can do.
I wouldn't be a citizen. Okay. Who is this Joe Biden? And tell me his story of coming to America. Was that before or after Corn Pop? I want to know, you know, was it before or after the gay guys that he saw kiss in the 1940s? Was it before or after he, marched with the civil rights movement and got arrested with Mandela and traveled 17,000 miles in Tibet with Xi? And it's just, he's lived many lives. I saw an interesting debate online, between people that were obviously Trump and Biden people. You know, Trump has filed a brief, claiming that former presidents should be immune from criminal prosecution for conduct, that involved official acts while in office. And of course, Trump was in office when he was challenging election results and accused of interfering with the constitutional sequence of electing a new president. And Trump has said, you know, presidents would be handcuffed and hampered were they not to enjoy that immunity, which traditionally has been ascribed to them and understood that they have. And the other person said, well, then are you saying that Biden should also have that immunity after he leaves office? Because isn't it in fact true, this person said, that you guys, meaning Trump supporters, allege that Biden is breaking the law, that he is committing high crimes and misdemeanors. You're trying to impeach him. And you won't succeed, just like they didn't succeed in impeaching Trump. I mean, they convicted him in the House, but they didn't try him and convict him and remove him from office. Same thing is going to happen with Biden. If this immunity claim is upheld, then of course it applies to all presidents. Do you believe that Biden should be charged and indicted after he leaves office. Well, my answer to that would be, in theory, yes, but I don't expect Republicans to do that. I don't expect, if Trump gets back in there, I don't expect that he'll do that. I have no expectation of that. I also don't, and I don't mean to be maudlin, I don't expect that Joe Biden will be around very long to do that. And if Robert Hur thinks he's a sympathetic figure now, by the time Biden leaves office, he will only be more so. Whatever we're describing in terms of age, infirmity, failed memory, unable to put things together, it's only going to be more true. But it is a good philosophical question. Going forward, does Trump change the rules? In other words, does the legal pursuit of Trump mean that we should be able to go after ex-presidents for things they do or didn't do in office that we believe or allege rise to the level of crimes? Or do we want to preserve the notion that there's immunity, that that office is unique, that presidents have to have the freedom to act in a way that is unique from other offices, other levels? It's going to be an interesting question going forward. 210-599-5555. I was reading about this guy named Mike Sington. I'd never heard of him. He was a longtime executive at NBC Universal. And Fox had a story about this, and Daily Caller had a story about this. Mike Sington is a middle-aged man. I'd never heard of him. He was an executive for many, many years at NBC Universal, and he apparently has an obsession with Barron Trump. He got a backlash recently for tweeting that Barron Trump is fair game now that he's turned 18 years old. He then deleted that post and said he wanted to clarify that he wasn't wishing harm on the former president's son. He had tweeted, Barron Trump turns 18 today. He's fair game now. He didn't apologize, but he deleted the tweet and explained that what he meant was he's fair game for criticism from the press. Still kind of weird, right? But Mike Sington has a history of tweeting about Barron Trump that goes back to when Barron was 12. He has many times tweeted about how handsome Barron Trump is, how tall he is, how he could be a model because he dresses so well. He tweeted at one point, and this is just very weird. I want to read this verbatim so I get it right. For his family's sake, I wish him the best, that he be gay and end up marrying a guy from a bleep hole country and they buy a nice home together in Mexico. Tweeted that in August of 2020. Why is a grown man posting pictures and tweeting about a boy who, when he started, was 12 and 13 years old, calling him cool and fashionable, and then, I guess, wishing other things on him? What is going on here? In fact, I noticed that the Democrats on the committee during the Bobulinski and other business associates' testimony, they were countering the accusations about Hunter Biden with accusations about Trump's kids. Now, look, Trump has his faults, many of them, obviously. And he does a lot of things that we might wish he didn't do or hadn't done. But, you know, I'm starting to think that what really motivates the talk about his wife and his kids is just jealousy. I think these people are kind of out of their minds because these people are impossibly rich. They're all good looking. They're all high achievers. I don't know about Barron. I don't think Barron's really done anything but go to school. But I mean, like, Trump's adult children have really been a credit to him. I mean, even Hillary, remember in the debate when she was asked to say one nice or positive thing about her opponent, She said, well, I got to give him credit for his kids. His kids are very impressive. And, you know, it's almost like, yes, he kind of looks crazy with the hair and the spray on tan and says some goofy things. But I think what really gets under their skin is their jealousy over these people. These people are leading lives that many in the media, many in the Democratic Party only wish for. And, you know, to be rich and to be good looking and to be smart and to be accomplished and to be effective defenders of their dad, it just seems to really unnerve them and drive them, you know, kind of crazy. I guess it's hard work when you're stuck defending Hunter Biden, you know, by comparison. That's a lot of heavy lifting. That's a lot of water to carry. All right, on the JR poll powered by River City Oral Surgery, we asked you, the U.S. is ranked the 23rd happiest country in the world. Is that ranking, in your opinion, too high, too low, or just right? Well, 50% think it's too high, that we should be even lower than that. 33% think we're too low, and 17% thought the rating was just right. New JR poll when we go live tomorrow at 4, or find it anytime at KTSA.com. And remember, our show is also available as an on-demand, full-episode podcast. You can get at KTSA.com or anywhere you like to get your other favorite podcasts. Well, earlier on this Throwback Thursday, we counted down the top 10 hits from this week in 1978. It was dominated by songs from the soundtrack to the movie Saturday Night Fever, which, of course, popularized disco around the world, threw off a lot of hit records, and made John Travolta, already well-known from his role in the TV sitcom Welcome Back, Kotter, an even bigger star and a household name in the movies. And this movie soundtrack from 1978, Saturday Night Fever, until Michael Jackson's Thriller came along, was the best-selling album of all time. Here is that number one song from this week in 78 on KTSA, Night Fever by the Bee Gees.